Hello, I'm Adrian Dobb.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
Whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So, Adrian, today we are talking about a whole new set of conservative freaks over in Germany, because we are debriefing the recent German elections from this weekend.
I think there's been a lot of attention paid to this election compared to other German elections. People tend to, well, interest in them tends to spike as the numbers for the Nazis tend to spike for reasons that are not actually that hard to fathom. But this was a particularly, I thought, like, closely watched one. I noticed that, you know, the New York Times had a sort of explainers, had five lessons from the German election, like the way you might almost treat, the way they're going to treat the Virginia elections later this year, I would think. Like, it really got a kind of treatment that I don't remember it getting in the last, in 2020. One when the last one was. I should say that we're joined today by a wonderful guest who I've been on podcasts with before, but we've a first time guest to In Bed with the Right, Annika Brockschmidt, who I should mention is a German journalist who specializes actually in U.S. conservatism and who sat out the recent election. Or while it was happening, were you on the plane? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I was. It was dark. I unfortunately had Wi-Fi because I had to finish an article, but it was pretty dark. Because I made some questionable life choices because I was not in fact in Germany.
Can you tell our listeners where you were?
Yeah, I was in the US at a tiny little conference at a place called National Harbor. In Maryland, in fact, at a national conference called CPAC.
The one place darker.
Yeah.
I think I've heard of it. Yeah.
You found the one place darker.
I found it. Mm-hmm.
A lot of influence of Germany, maybe like mid-century Germany at CPAC. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could say that my spidey senses didn't just tingle. They were on like full vibrate the whole time, which, it was pretty dark. Had a moment where let's not call him a journalist, a media person from the Epoch Times tried to argue with me that the Nazis were in fact leftists. So that was fun.
Epoch Times is that?
Yeah, the cult, yeah.
That's the Falun Gong.
I mean, I was like, is it the Moonies or is it the Falun Gong? Like,
it's the same people who do that Shen Yun dance exhibition. Yeah, China before communism. Now we're sidetracked.
First of all, we should clarify. Any resonances with mid-century Germany you saw, it's the Roman salute.
Which is infinitely better because Italian fascism is just breezy, you know? But even that is fitting because, I don't know, did you guys see the one picture of one of the placards at CPAC that was like a Trump head, like an AI version of Trump?
So that was real. I was wondering about
that. That was real.
Wait, what was the... Was it? Sorry, go on.
It's called the Third Term Project, and, you know, I don't know if Steve Bannon is affiliated with it, because he teased it, basically, as an idea, Trump 2028, and it's Trump as an AI-generated version of Trump as a Roman emperor, like as a marble white statue with a laurel wreath, a little pretty mid-century German eagle on top of him.
So he wants a kind of a Reich... third kind. So that's not alarming, which is good. Well, we should leave our creeps for a moment, though. We'll get back to them, dear listeners, because this is a fairly international election that just happened in Germany. But I think we're going to need to walk our listeners, and I think, Moira, we might need to walk you a little bit through what happened.
Yeah, I was telling these guys before we started recording that I am kind of the vulgar American here, because if you're an American and you, even if you cover American politics, as I do for my job, it's very easy to like not know that much about like particularly like European politics. And it's very easy to understand European politics in terms of like analogies or proxies for American political interests, right? So like, you know, you hear like, okay, Angela Merkel, she was kind of like a Hillary Clinton figure. You know, like that's the way Americans think of it. Like they got theirs in.
The Germans are wagging their head. They're like, meh.
I'm not saying this is accurate. saying this is how I understand it when I'm at the baseball game putting a hot dog in my face. But like what was really sort of the buzz around this election was Elon Musk's throwing his support behind the AFD. The question was, is his backing of the Nazis going to work in Germany the way it had worked with phenomenal success for him in the U.S.? And the results seem to have been fair to mixed for Musk in Germany. But I don't really know what all of this means. So I'm interested in what you guys have to say about it.
So I think that's great framing. So, you know, just I mean, maybe let's just do the basics. So the election happened on Sunday, February 23rd. And we're going to be talking about, I think the fact that you're bringing up Musk is kind of telling. Like, I think ultimately Musk's role in this election is more complicated than even he probably knows. Like, there were other parties
vying for his attention. This was prominent German politicians of, I'm sure we'll go through the parties in a second, but of the CDU and the FDP. So non-AFD parties is the relevant point. Openly, trying to flatter Musk.
They were sliding into his DMs. They were sliding into his replies.
Yeah, but instead of doing that, which would have been even more, at least somewhat more dignified, they just posted at him publicly. Being like, oh, you're supporting the AFD. You must be misinformed. They're right-wingers. And everybody who has spent a second scrolling through Elon Musk's timeline would have gone, he knows that. That's why he's supporting them. That's precisely the reason.
I know a little bit about the CDU and their attempt to shift to the right over this past election to try and capture some of the voters that they lost to the AFD. Tell me a little bit about the FDP, because I don't know about as much about them at all.
So maybe it makes sense to kind of walk through the parties in general, because there are by now a whole lot of them. And Annika, I thought maybe you and I want to take turns going through these. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about the current government. So the current government dissolved, and this will already get us to the FDP. The current government consisted of the SPD, which is a social democratic party that under its current, well, no longer current boss and no longer current chancellor, Olaf Scholz, has sort of migrated to the right. Everyone has migrated to the right, basically, with one prominent exception, and kind of occupies a position that I would think is sort of a centrist Democrat, right? Like with a couple of things that centrist Democrats don't tend to believe. So the SPD was leading this motley coalition that kind of didn't want to govern together, but there were no alternatives when the government was formed.
That does sound like the Democrats. Sorry.
Yeah. The second party in that group, the second biggest party in that coalition is the Green Party, which, you know, kind of comes out of the 1960s student movement, comes out of sort of, you know, alternative forms of politics, but it has become heavily professionalized under Robert Habeck, who... I don't know how to describe Robert Habeck.
I was going to say, I'm so curious to see how you're going to describe him.
Sincerity. He seems very sincere. He was a politician who very early on took to Instagram and doing these videos that are just very earnest, straight to camera.
But not, for example, not in the way that you would think of AOC. The way that an AOC does. It's a very different, it's very quite produced, and it feels put on. It's a bit too much.
It's like I'm being reminded of Jonathan Safran Foer. Is it like if Jonathan Safran Foer was a German politician?
It's if your social studies teacher who was cool and with it 15 years ago, but still is like trying to sort of be buddies with you. And
he's the kind of guy who would in a movie about the cool teacher, he would turn the chair around and then, you know, push up his sleeves.
Oh,
that's
my
the vibe.
God. Okay, so he's patronizing and corny.
Oh yeah. He's a deeply corny man. And of course, one should say the part of the Green Party, right? It came out of opposition to third quarter of the 20th century style German politics, and it was sort of the professionally young party. It part of its first deputies in the parliament would show up in sweaters.
Yeah, they would like knit, they would bring like potted plants into parliament. So they like broke with decorum rules.
It sounds like the legacy of the new left. Adrian and I are in California, which is the paradigmatic
exactly
example of how the new left turned reactionary in this like late 20th century curdling effect. What did that happen with the Green Party, or have they stayed more on the left but just gotten kind of like annoying?
I would say they have a very broad spectrum of people who vote for them. So it very much also depends on, which is why the federal election becomes so interesting, because if in state politics, it very much depends where you are and which state you are, what kind of Green Party you're going to get. So, for example, the Green Party in the South, in Baden-Württemberg, that's not Bavaria, that's the other one.
Where I'm from.
But the other big state in the South is basically a, let's say, slightly more liberal version of the CDU, I would say, the Green Party there. They're very, like, depending on where they are, they can be quite, you know, car manufacturer friendly. That is the Baden-Württemberg example. And they essentially are made up out of two wings. One is the sort of more in the legacy of the origins of the party that clashed in this election, for example, with the party leadership under Robert Habeck, because he thought it was a great idea to, you know, get some of that anti-migration sentiment maybe in the polls. We're going to see how that worked out. Not well. Yeah. Surprise.
Yeah, so there are these two wings, and Annika's right. It's extremely regional. I would say that in the big cities, they tended to clean up in the big cities. They really, like, the number of mayors that are Greens or were Greens sort of in the last 5 years is staggering. But in the states where they are successful beyond that, they have a more right-wing profile. And part of that, as Moira knows from some of our other episodes, has to do with the fact that there is a right-wing eco-friendly contingent in Germany, which in the United States has become this kind of impossibility. But there are these people who are like, we must protect our natural habitats from, you know, car emissions, nuclear power, and immigrants. And you're like, wait, what?
Oh, that's RFK Jr., dude. That's like, yeah. It's Make America Healthy Again. It's the crunchy reactionary. Ecofascism, we do have it here. It's just, it's not as prominent.
Yeah. Although I think ecofascist for that wing is probably putting it too strongly.
I would say reactionary is more fitting for them. Because I feel like there was a moment a couple of years ago, you know, when Fridays for Future started here, where a lot of the younger leaders of that mass protest movement then started political careers in, if not in the Green Party, then within their, like, let's say, think tank surrounding area. So for a while, I think, and I think we're going to see this when we look at, you know, where do voters go? How do voters switch between parties? That we are now at a moment where a lot of young voters who used to vote for the Green Party because they thought they might be a climate conscious alternative of a left-leaning party to, you know, the Social Democrats are big into coal because of their whole legacy as the
Union Party.
So they're very, climate is tricky for them. So, but also people who were not happy with Die Linke, maybe didn't like their foreign policy. So these were also young voters who used to vote for the Green Party. But I think there were, we could see, and we could see this also in the results, that there were a lot of people who were not happy with how flexible the Greens proved to be in government, because we were talking about the former government.
One other point, Moira, that's important, I think, maybe for our listeners in terms of the way these coalitions work, right? You basically, they get together and they divvy up the different ministries. And basically, the more you bring to the table in terms of percentages in parliament, the better. There are ministries no one wants, like international development, And then there are ones that are like, where you always look awesome, defense, right? Where you're like, everyone loves the Secretary of Defense for some fucking reason.
Is that a German thing, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, let's not delve too deeply into that. Yeah.
Oh boy.
but I think there is an element of, right, so the Greens became kind of victims of their own success in the last election, in the sense that they wound up with a foreign ministry, which tends to be quite powerful, and the ministry of for basically the finance and the economy, which meant that they had to kind of make these deals with industry on climate, which like a lot of voters were like, well, why did the fuck did I vote for a Green Party? If they're like, yeah, we have to make sure that, you know, we can still build gas burning cars in like 40 years. And like, well, great. Maybe we should build boats, you guys, because it seems like we're going to need boats. And then in the foreign ministry, right, Annalena Baerbock very much carried the course, the German course, on Israel-Palestine.
Under the banner of feminist foreign policy.
Right. Meaning these were two things where the party leadership and young voters, I think, were very seriously out of step.
So I understand that the Greens lost because of these, like in part because of these contradictions within the coalition. Or they lost ground in these most recent elections.
Lost ground, but respectably. -3% if you're the junior party in a coalition. You always lose if you're a junior partner. It's not too bad.
Yeah, that's not too bad. So that was within the scope of what was to be expected. Considering that Robert Habeck thought he could be chancellor, that's a different thing, but I think that might be a Robert Habeck thing, yeah.
Little embarrassing, but it definitely not like... Some like the SPD lost 9%. I mean, absolutely
shellacking. Yeah,
horrible result. Yeah, and speaking of shellackings, the FDP.
Ooh boy, strap it. See, this is the part of the podcast that makes me happy.
Yes, so it's not all bad news. We're gonna get to the really bad news later, but this is the funny news.
Very funny.
So the FDP was the junior partner. They brought the fewest amount of votes into this coalition. They didn't really want to join this government because they don't like governing so much as like running populist campaigns where they're like, oh, would you like to pay less taxes and also get more stuff? And then people are like, how are you going to do that? And they're like, don't worry about that.
Are they like they're a right-wing populist party?
They're a libertarian kind of pro-business.
I find them quite interesting because the FDP used to have in the before times, long, long ago, they used to have a sort of more socially inclined liberal wing. That is long, long gone. Very long gone. And in fact, one of the bigwigs of the FDP, who I believe was one of their founding members, if I remember correctly, died a couple of days ago. Before his death, gave basically an interview saying, "I don't know what that party is. Doesn't have anything to do with me anymore." So they made a hard right wing populist / libertarian turn under former head now. Sorry, Christian Lindner.
Feels good just to say that, doesn't it?
How to best describe Christian Lindner? So Christian Lindner.
On my Substack, I said he's the human answer to a question. What if a meme coin fucked a ski instructor?
That's a really evocative type of guy description.
Every FDP politician looks like the guy who is selling you a mortgage and you kind of think you're getting worked, but you don't know enough to know how.
Or like a timeshare.
Yeah, yeah. Like they're all like, they're dressed very nattily. They are sort of like, they look younger than they are, right? They like, they have a kind of youthfulness, but the kind of youthfulness that like does well on public television, you know, like the kind of person who like is professionally young, but you're like numerically not, right? Like you're actually ancient. Like
Carson Daly.
And so they joined this government and then proceeded to basically campaign against the government while being in it. There's a very funny moment where these right-wing farmers blockaded a road in Berlin.
That was our version of the trucker protest.
Lindner shows up as the cognizant minister, right? He's in charge.
And he's like, somebody should really do something about this. Like, you're grieving.
Yeah. He's like, fuck this government. Like, I'm with you. And everyone's like,
what do you mean?
I don't know how to put this. You're management.
I love it when they do that.
And he got booed.
He got booed. He still got booed. Right? So he's like, it's these like too clever by half schemes. So they're the masters of these.
Yeah.
The clever ploy that ends up with a bunch of shit on their face for some weird mm-hmm. reason. You're like, well, that didn't work. Speaking of which, that's how the government dissolved.
Uh-huh.
So they basically clearly wanted out. They were unhappy in this government, even though this government gave them everything they wanted, frankly. So they basically conned Olaf Scholz into shit-canning Christian Lindner and throwing the FDP out of the government.
Which was funny. I'm sorry. That was very funny.
It was very, very funny.
He got publicly fired. I did not know. Maybe I just had never paid attention to that part of German politics. I just couldn't remember the last time a minister got shit-canned.
No.
So they didn't be like, I'm leaving to go be president of this university. They're like, hey, no, we're firing you. We're going to... It's like... Because normally when a politician gets pushed out, they allow them to save face in some way. And he made a very public break.
He had essentially managed to push a politician that seems not capable of human emotion, Olaf Scholz, so much to the breaking point that he not only held what was his equivalent of an angry rant live on television and then proceeded to fire him, but he actually provoked him into that reaction and then played victim. I was unceremoniously fired.
So like with many of their schemes, this one totally backfired.
This is like Desperate Housewives.
It is.
With the exception that the Desperate Housewives would not be stupid enough to write about how they're going to con the government into firing them and breaking the coalition.
Wait. He manipulated his own firing so that he could play the righteous victim. But then he took notes on this conspiracy.
Yes.
Yeah.
He like put it all. He's like, I'm doing this on purpose, by the way.
Yeah, behind the scenes, I think that there are still some serious people in that party, and they were pissed as hell mm-hmm. at him. There are some people who actually quit the party and stayed in government, and were like, no, I'm doing my job, mm-hmm. what the hell, right? But it's very clear that he had shared these emails far too widely, and these memos, which also used the word D-Day, and everyone was like, that feels real inappropriate, dude. Yeah, and so that was that kind of came out right after he, like, was like, oh, I'm the victim here. Like, I'm ideologically pure, et cetera, et cetera. I think the party just never recovered from it. He then made the choice. This party generally loves a kind of a meme campaign, and so his new meme was, he's like, oh, Germany needs more Musk and more Milei. So Javier Milei of Argentina, right? This was right before Elon Musk basically, you know, started just doing Hitler salutes every chance you give him, right?
About 2 weeks before.
Excellent timing. It was also right before Elon Musk endorsed a party that was very much not the FDP.
Not the FDP. I gotta say, like, the American, like, caricature of Germany is that it's composed of very serious, disciplined, intelligent people. And I love being surprised by the emergence of, like, German idiots. It's like, wait a minute.
Yes. Yeah, German idiot will be the name of his biography one day.
To be fair, I can't believe I'm even saying that. To be fair to Christian Lindner, he wasn't the only one who was vying for Elon Musk's attention. We also had Carsten Linnemann, who is the, how do you translate Generalsekretär?
Oh, Secretary General. Yes. Yeah, I don't think they have that.
Something like that. So pretty high up in leadership of the CDU said, and I love how German this is all sounding, at a campaign event in Wolfenbüttel right before Christmas, that we really need a German version of Doge, preferably led by a private businessman, you know, somebody who knows how to run an enterprise? Somebody like Elon Musk.
So, like, this might be a little bit of a tangent, but what do German politicians think they're going to get from Musk beyond just, like, funding for their campaigns?
German campaign finance law is more narrowly...
Yeah, it's a little more sane. It's
like pre-Citizens United, basically. And so, like, very hard to imagine. I mean, getting free publicity from Elon Musk obviously doesn't hurt on X, for instance. On the other hand, I really think, right, this is a country that still has nominally, to whatever extent, a sense that it probably shouldn't vote for a strong man again. And, you know, plunge the world into yet another fascist dictatorship.
Don't worry, we're doing that for you. Don't worry about it, guys.
But what these right-wing parties have discovered is basically the thing that we also see in the United States, that being like, oh, I'm not the Führer, I'm a CEO, right? I'm actually the leader of this. I'm going to treat the government like a company where I can hire and fire anyone. It's like, so a dictator? No, like a CEO. Well, but kind of like a dictator CEO, right? No. How crazy? It's all about economic liberalization. It's like, it kind of sounds like you're describing a strongman, except that you're using the language of business where, mm-hmm. frankly, we've been far too inured and accepting of mm-hmm. strong hierarchies yeah. and personal rule to make a point about broader politics. So yeah. I think that's why they're doing it. They say Musk because they're not allowed to say Hitler, I think yeah. is what it is, right? Like, they're like, we need a strong leader figure to clean up, but like not in a Hitler way, in a Musk way. But so just to, you know, in terms of the FDP, in the end, was probably the biggest loser of the evening on Sunday, and this did not work out. In fact, they came just short of 5%, which is a pretty important number in German politics, because if you garner less than 5% of the vote, you can't be in parliament, basically. Well, there are some exceptions, but those were not going to apply to them, so they were out.
Which is essentially a right. lesson learned from the Weimar period, to prevent having an inordinate amount of teeny tiny splinter parties and very unstable coalitions that keep changing. So that's why the 5% hurdle is in place. And the FDP
yep.
did not meet it.
So is one of these lessons, because it sounds like a lot of these people have both tried to pivot towards Musk and to pivot right more generally. And that seems to be broadly failing for everybody except the AfD and the CDU.
So that's the question. Did it work for the CDU or not? That's sort of the million-dollar question. And unfortunately, the problem is there's an opinion that I'm guessing Annika and I have, which is it didn't work. But the problem is they might have a different opinion, right? There is enough evidence to sustain the opposite reading. So maybe, Annika, do you want to walk us through what's the CDU's whole deal?
So the CDU... In order to understand where the CDU currently is, so the CDU, that is short for Christdemokratische Union, so that means Christian Democratic Union. That's because the CDU is not just one party, but technically maybe like one and a half, because it also has
counterpart, its Bavarian, sister party, yeah.
I don't know, sister party, that counterpart that kind of belongs, it doesn't make any sense, but it's there. So, and after a very, very long time of Angela Merkel at the head of the CDU, it was 16 years, they essentially were in limbo for a while, because Merkel, as Adrian already said, basically had steered the CDU. It was still a conservative party, but it was more of a centrist with conservative tendencies, but more centrist leaning than leaning towards the hard right. So I would say under Merkel, at least she signaled there isn't an open right-wing flank that we're tolerating. That is closed. Even though, of course, it's, you know, the people who are now rejoicing, part of them were already there. But you had this movement within the party in Merkel's later years, with, you know, anti-immigrant sentiment rising, with the AfD gaining more votes, that basically blamed the rise of the AfD on Merkel's poor migration, on Merkel's policies of 2015, where she said, of course, we're going to let refugees in. You know, that's what asylum law is for. And this is the whole "wir schaffen das," we're going to make this work moment. And so the right wing of the CDU had essentially been like chomping at the bit for a while to finally get her out of the way. And there was a tussle in leadership, various figures that for various reasons lack of political talent, lack of charisma. Although, I mean, no. Talking about Friedrich Merz, that man is a lot of things, but not charismatic. didn't work out. And so that, in effect, enabled the rise of, at least I think he would see himself as that, a man who considers himself to be Angela Merkel's arch nemesis within the party.
With all the gendered implications of that, one should say, right? There is also a kind of, like, the whole daddy's back thing that you get from people like J.D. Vance in the United States. There is some of that here.
Yeah, the restoration of masculine leadership as part of a pivot to the right in the party as well as,
Which is all about him and not about her, one should say. Like, sure, Merkel's leadership style, like, she did mobilize her own femininity in certain ways, right? The Mutti thing, the kind of motherhood thing she would sometimes do. On the other hand, this is just kind of how the CDU runs. The CDU for a long time has had chancellors that have just basically been in office forever. And just anytime someone else is talented or at all popular, they kick him out. Basically, they're like, I can't have any rivals within my party. This is what Helmut Kohl did in the 80s and early 90s. And it's what Merkel did during her 16 years in office. But it's clear that Merz understood it as a gendered attack. He understood it as, like, you know, this woman.
Like, as a personal slight. Yeah, this woman took the job that I am entitled to, even though I never have won an election ever.
Yeah. Well, I guess.
Yeah. Well,
Sunday.
Now, yeah.
But it's Sunday, yeah. First time for everything. How old is the man now? 70 or...
I don't know. He's one of, I think he looks older than he is.
69. He's 69 years old. Nice. There are a whole bunch of cultural things that we could get into where he really sort of, he is her antipode. He sort of thinks that the core of the CDU really is not in this, not anything centrist. It has to be sort of its right flank, which had been indeed marginalized during the Merkel years. He is regionally, right? He's from West Germany.
Sauerland.
He's in Sauerland. He's Catholic. She's the Protestant minister's daughter, I believe. Right? So, like, those are distinctions that still do matter for, well, not for me, but for the kinds of people who vote for this party. They can matter.
There is a certain type of hard right Catholic boys club thing. Mm.
Yeah, we have one of those.
That is a factor here.
The CDU used to have a very strong metropolitan wing, and I think Merkel was able to revive that to some extent. But really, both Merkel and Merz represent a kind of rural wing of the party, I would say. Like, there's an infamous thing where he went to some Bavarian festival in a place I don't even know where that is, to be honest. And he's like, well, this is real Germany, not like... And then he picked on a... largely immigrant neighborhood in Berlin, and you're like, so basically they're very, very clear on, like, where the real Germany is, and it is occupied by the 25% of people who vote for them. Yeah. Basically everyone else is just not a real German, so, you know, stop me if you've heard this one before.
He's also a former BlackRock guy who owns a private plane but refers to himself as middle class, so.
but this is kind of Matt's whole deal. This, he is a kind of leader for this moment where, right, you have all the power. People like you've had all the power all along, but you still are able to see yourself as an outsider, as somehow wronged by even the fact that there was, like, a lady in charge for, like, a hot minute there. You're like, you know, I will now destroy everything.
And his current grievance is that there have been protests against this lurch to the right, not just with the CDU, but there were also protests. So there have been protests for about over a year, mass protests in Germany against this rightward move of parties of the democratic spectrum when it comes to migration policy. However, Friedrich Merz, I think it was it 2 weeks before the election? So, just to be clear, from a strategic, not even from a moral standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, you're the one big criticism that you get that might lose you voters is that people think you're like signaling too close to the AfD. You have, as Friedrich Merz has, he had previously a couple of years ago said, for example, if any elected CDU politician, even if it's on a just on a local level, if they pass anything with AfD votes, so if something can only pass if the AfD votes with you, the next morning they're going to be expelled from this party. That used to be the position a couple of years ago. Now, if Friedrich Merz were to care about stuff he said a couple of years ago, he would have had to kick himself out of his own party. Because, I think it was 2 or 2.5 weeks before the election, he and the CDU decided to break a post-1945 taboo. It's always a great sentence to start with in German parliament, which is that you don't vote with fascists on anything. And the thing that made this so absolutely batshit, just not even from a historical perspective, all of that is clear. I didn't need to go into that. But from a strategic perspective is that this wasn't a vote that was going to lead to anything. It was clear that it wouldn't pass. It was merely a signaling of vibes.
The purpose was to break the taboo. The purpose was to invite further collaborations with the Nazis. Yeah.
And one should say that as these protests then heated up, he basically called for and is now apparently pursuing investigations into NGOs that he thinks are running this, which, I mean, this is something that's recognizable, which is something that I think maybe to American listeners is not as clear. That's how Viktor Orban consolidated power in Hungary. So he's very, very clearly, this is how the PiS government in Poland operated. He is signaling already, basically he's cribbing from the playbook, not of center-right parties, which still do exist across Europe, but from far-right autocrats in Europe.
When you look at the religious landscape in Germany, when you look at how churches are organized, it's a lot more hierarchical and a lot more structured than in the US. So there's essentially there's structures that are called Landeskirchen for Catholics and Protestants. So there's not much out there. There are some, you know, Freikirchen, there are some
evangelical churches.
Evangelical, but I think they would be more seen like sects here because they're fairly small, just regarding size. So it's fairly ordered. And the CDU, it has the C in the name. The Christian is in the name. And so when Merz announced his hardcore anti-migration policies, actually the official Landeskirchen, so both Protestants and Catholics, spoke out against it, which interestingly led to both leading figures of the CDU and the CSU to threaten churches. Markus Söder there's a prominent CSU guy. Markus Söder did an event where he said, now you really should be concerning yourself with the Christian topics, you know, stuff like saving unborn life and stuff like that, because it would be pretty bad for you, wouldn't it, if you had no one by your side, if people came for you. So it was a very clear case of nice church you have there, would be a shame if something were to happen to it, which then led to several, to be fair, local, but several local CDU politicians saying, oh, I've stopped going to my like Protestant Catholic church, I'm now going to the Evangelical Freikirche.
A question I have as an outside observer is, how is the CDU differentiating itself from the AfD, who are nominally still their competitors? Are they just trying to seem as identical as possible? Are they trying to be more palatable to a mainstream in any way? Like, what's the meaningful difference?
Part of it is it's hard to know how much they mean, but like certainly their rhetoric is very copy-paste. And so I think maybe what we should tell our listeners, right? Like, so this is the party that won this election after a fashion, right? So that's 28.6%. And everything, I think, in the coming weeks and months, and maybe even years, will hinge on how that party interprets that number.
I mean, we already have Friedrich Merz saying that he thinks that they weren't right-wing enough on immigration stuff.
Exactly. So there is that reading, right? Like, they didn't shrink the AfD enough. Well, they doubled them, to be exact. But to their mind, if they had tacked harder to the right, the AfD would not have made it to 20%, right? But as any political scientist will tell you, that, you know, this has never worked all across Europe. Ceding ground to the far right strengthens the far right. And one should say, you know, the government that Olaf Scholz was leading was spectacularly unpopular. He was spectacularly unpopular. The FDP was subterranean in its popularity, right? Meaning gaining 4% on your previous result, where you were just getting completely clobbered, is really not that impressive at all. And I think, everyone was kind of looking for a number north of 30 at the least, I think, in order
very
to say
least,
like,
yeah.
And that's not what happened. So it's very interesting. And there are, one should say, mostly retired politicians. Angela Merkel came out even before the election saying that this was a mistake. But there are other former allies of her, including a former president, who said, look, the numbers don't bear this out. We made a mistake tacking that far to the right. What are you talking about? 28% is abysmal. We have to course correct. But these are all people who are retired, all people who no longer really matter for the party. So it's a little bit like these Never Trump Republicans who find their voice. And
even them, they're pretty quiet lately, because a lot of them are getting, various...
Yeah.
Threats to their funding or livelihood, so a lot of them aren't even really speaking out. They're just going off into the night.
Where should we go next in terms of looking at the parties? Maybe we should talk briefly before we get to the AfD, which obviously is the the big winner
the
of
big
this
show.
Election, the big
yeah.
show. Maybe we should talk about the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, because this is a really fascinating and another kind of a story that I think we might have to devote an entire episode on at some point, because Sarah Wagenknecht what was her actual position in Die Linke? So she was part of the Linkspartei, the left party, sort of post-communist. She had the mm-hmm. role of mm-hmm. being mm-hmm. on talk shows, as best as I could tell. She was talk show.
She was the public face of the Linkspartei in every god-awful talk show that is on German television.
She's married to, I think she's still married to, right? A former SPD politician who left that party over sort of its neoliberalization and founded this left alternative. She was sort of like, I don't know, she was the media darling. The Linkspartei has a lot of very good people in terms of TV appearances. Like, they're entertaining. They are left populist, so they can be scabrous.
Was she good on TV?
She's quite quick. She's
quite quick. She's brilliant, clearly.
Witty, very, very good orator. She's charismatic. And her whole thing, I think she sort of made herself into a brand before that was really a thing for politicians. So she kind of does what I can only describe as Rosa Luxemburg cosplay, kind of.
Okay, yeah.
Like, just the hair and the choker. So that is the image that she's always tried to evoke, which I always found very interesting. So she always was this sort of firebrand leftist politician that would go into all of these talk shows where you usually have, like, white-haired men of the age of 60 and sort of give them hell. That was sort of her starting point.
She's incendiary. She's probably kind of sexy. She's probably funny, a little irreverent, maybe.
She's not unattractive. She's charismatic, but she never traded on any of that. No.
Yes. If you Google Rosa Luxemburg, the hair, she has sort of almost like matronly hair. It's kind of this braid, and then it's tucked.
So the important thing about her over the last couple of years, though, is that so she's become more important as sort of like an intellectual figurehead than she ever was in organizing that party. And the people I know in that party were frustrated with her for years, because she's very good at sort of getting conversations started, and then her follow through appeared to be pretty bad. Now, the funny thing was that she kind of carved out a space that, Moira, you will recognize immediately, which was she would go on TV and mostly criticize her own party. And people were like, okay, so you're the most visible member of our party, and then you keep shitting on us. Do we think this is a good strategy? Anyway, that was her thing, right? She would always go about, like, the left. And I think that had two parts of it. One was she was very clearly kind of starting to stake out a position that she thought of as other, and others thought of as, like, akin to, like, the Danish Social Democrats, right? Right-wing on social issues, but lefty on economic issues, right?
That's very popular now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so she tried to stake that out. And then the other thing she did was basically this kind of anti-woke shtick, right? She was like, my party's yes. gotten too woke. Like, there's too much about gender in this.
Yes. A lot of anti-trans stuff.
Anti-trans stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So they frame it differently than the AfD. If you go into the party program, you see similar anti-trans policies, only that the Bündnis Arab Wagenknecht frames it as a women's rights issue.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's more a British yeah. turf version than a classically, like...
It's turf stuff, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so she's basically, I mean, what would you call that? She's the diagonalist. She's like a classical yeah. diagonalist in that she's combining...
A figure of the realignment, yeah.
She's making common cause with the right wing on a bunch of things, and weirdly enough, kind of started really underselling her own class politics, right? Which she has. I mean, but like she just didn't hit that as much anymore, right?
They completely forgot about it and essentially only focused in the campaign on these two things, on anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's kind of this mix of reactionary, little bit left-wing, but mostly also nationalist. It's a kind of lefty coated version of reactionary nationalism.
Yeah, like a nationalism that's also socialist. I mean, what could go wrong? The important thing here is that the Bündnis Arab Wagenknecht ended up with 4.97% of the vote.
Remember what we said about the 5%. So that was the second funny thing of the night.
This is fucking funny. My heart would break for her if she wasn't such a piece of shit. But like, it is very funny that she was short like 1,000 votes. So she had this huge breakup with her party, and everyone's like, well, they're toast now. Like this one person who like had all the charisma and all the energy behind her now left. They're just going to get eaten alive. Well, funny thing happened. The other side definitely won that breakup in the sense that Die Linke doubled its result to almost 9%. Very respectable. To give you an idea, there were three sort of senior members of that party that were touring Germany, just trying to retain their direct mandates. In Germany, you both vote for a party and for a candidate. This was a desperate way to kinda get into parliament on a technicality. So this party, as little as a month ago, were like, shit, this is probably the only way we can do this. They didn't need any of that. I mean,
they were polling at 3-4% consistently. Wow. Like, so everybody expected maybe they're going to get in on this technicality via those three sort of old guard politicians that might win their districts, but no way they're going to get in.
Who did? But they didn't need it. Yeah. So it turned out that like they got a full glow up for out of the breakup and a ton of new voters, a lot of new people joining it. And from the way the voter migration statistics seem to shake out, a lot of it disaffected Greens and SPD members.
Yes.
Okay. Who, you know, so not drawing a lot of people away from the AfD, but then again, no one was drawing a lot of people away from the AfD. We should mention, by the way, that the Bündnis Arab Wagenknecht, which she had sort of positioned as like, I can draw some of these people back from the AfD that we've lost to them over the years, appears to have drawn 60,000 voters away from the AfD. So nothing. Absolutely nothing. Yeah. So turns out, guys, that also doesn't work. So anyway, so now, unfortunately, we have to talk about the 20.4% elephant in the room, which is the AfD.
Nazis. Yeah.
The Nazis. I hate those guys. Oh, and just in case we have German listeners, First Amendment bitches, we can call them Nazis all we want.
Wait, you can't call them Nazis in Germany? To explain
this. You can call them fascist, I believe.
No, you can call Höcke fascist. That
Oh yeah.
is court sanctioned, which is telling you something about how fascist he is. If a German court under German libel law says you can definitely call that guy a fascist because that is fascist stuff, he says.
The raised right arm really was a first clue.
I'm not interested
in, I mean, maybe I'll get sued, but I'm not particularly interested in not calling Nazis Nazis. Like, it's the pulley test, the technicalities, these are morally offensive.
We'll just in case, just so that Annika doesn't get sued, they give real bad guys in the first and third Indiana Jones movie. Is all we'll say. One of the comparisons that is easy to make is obviously the Rassemblement National, which also sort of keeps coming back year after year in France. And this is Marine Le Pen's party, for those who don't follow the French tragedy. Basically, come back year after year a little bit stronger and just eating away at the French basically political establishment and frankly at the foundations of that particular republic. But one of the things is about the Rassemblement is that Marine Le Pen has been very consistent in basically, she doesn't move the party to the left, but she head fakes towards moderation each time, right? I would say she tries to sort of she threw out her own dad, right? Like she kind of
the Holocaust denier,
right? Like she sort of she does clean house from time to time. We should say that the AfD, if anything, has undergone a opposite development. The AfD started really where the FDP is today. It was a professor's party. It was a bunch of people. They still have, I think, have the highest number of PhDs in their ranks in parliament. It's a bunch of dudes in bow ties basically explaining to you how like Javier Milei has some good ideas. Like that was the beginning. Yeah. It was your econ prof.
It was anti Euro reactionary econ.
Who also didn't care for immigrants, but that was sort of that was secondary, right? Yeah.
That was a
and
side
in the last
piece
and
for
they
them,
were
yeah.
founded what in 2013? In the last 12 years, they have, if anything, radicalized with every single election. Or if we want to keep with the Marine Le Pen analogy, we'd say the veneer has come off with every single.
They're trying to hide it less and less.
Like whether or not there's a genuine change here or whether or not it's just like there was a time when they hid these people. Now.
Yeah, they don't. Now Alice Weidel is signaling to Höcke, that's the guy you're legally allowed to call a fascist in Germany, signaling him that his wing of the party, which is the Völkisch wing, you know, just that, you know, they're not just welcome, but they have a bright future ahead of them.
I'm sorry to depress our listeners so much, but like basically the AfD gained 20.4% of the vote. One in five German voters voted for these guys. They have 152 seats in parliament. There are a bunch of things that come with that that is really important. But in some way, the regional profile is even more dire. That is to say, it is, Annika's right, it's the first time that a far-right party or a post-fascist party has come in second in a national election. They used to not make it into parliament at all, as little as 20 years ago. They have also, they are the strongest party in several of the states. I don't think like by a lot, but by it's not significantly. Now, if you look at the map, everyone, when the New York Times explains this, they're going to be like, well, here's East Germany, and there you can see how strong the AfD is in East Germany. They are perfectly strong in East Germany. This is true. At the same time, I think this is one of those phantom debates that Germans love having and that frankly, people love having about Germany. That, like, is, like, they did extremely well in the West as well. They got a direct mandate in the Ruhr region, which is old SPD territory. It's the former coal mining area.
Coal mining.
Where my grandparents are from, near Kaiserslautern, they did extremely well. These towns,
I saw that.
What is definitely true is they in cities they tend to do poorly, though there are some exceptions. But they're definitely making inroads, and they seem to be running up the score, as far as I can tell, sort of in small cities, sort of like 40,000 to 80,000 people. It's a small city with a larger town with like, you know, your, I don't know, Altoona, Pennsylvania kind of thing, with like a with often dependent on a couple of industries that are faltering, often frankly with a pretty abysmal age profile. My grandparents lived in a city kind of like this, and they tend to be quite old. Young people tend to leave, and I think there's also by now a gender component to this, which is to say young women tend to leave at much higher rates than young men. And there is a one should say, a extreme gender gap that has opened up. The left, the Linkspartei, cleaned up among women under age 30, I think, and like the AfD did extremely well
with men
under that age. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which at this point is also probably it's gender sorting, but it's also geographic sorting. My impression is that these young women are not living next door to those young men.
Is it a similar issue to the United States where more women are enrolling in college, or is that not happening as much?
I think there might be some of that. I think there is, some of it is has to do with, the kinds of jobs people still go into in Germany, right? I think that there are sort of traditional crafts that are heavily male dominated, and that's why people stay in these areas. But I don't entirely know. It's honestly something that political journalism in Germany doesn't tend to talk about that much, because they're totally fixated on kind of like on East-West, right?
The East-West thing. The tale is basically the the common narrative is the AfD is so strong in the East because, you know, those were the people living in the GDR and they never learned democracy, is sort of the usual take on that.
Bumpkins from East Germany.
Yeah, exactly. Who got their minds broken by communism. Now, we should say, for those playing along at home, right, the Berlin Wall fell, 36 years ago? 1989, 36 years ago, right? Meaning, for you to have been meaningfully socialized in that area, you have to be older than 46 years old, right?
Adrian, you can't start
so
with
it's,
facts.
It's really, it does seem very strange to kind of point to that. That's not to say that there aren't differences. Like there is, you know, this was a place, you know, like sort of like your coal country in Pennsylvania was a place that was hit by neoliberal disinvestment from most of their heavy industries before the West was hit. So there might well be a kind of time delay going on here. It's not to say that there aren't significant differences. Also, it is an area that is just factually depopulated, which is frankly also true for parts of Rhineland-Palatinate, it's true for parts of North Rhine-Westphalia, it's part true for Lower Saxony. The people are just urbanizing to a greater extent, and there's a different kind of economy that goes along with it. So, like, none of this is to say, like, oh, it's completely made up. But you'd be like, oh, it's post-communism. It's like, no, not really. It's post-neoliberalism, really, is what probably we're looking at here.
Do you know what I found interesting? And I'm wondering what your take on this is, and Maura, yours as well, is because, so I pulled up, have in front of me the polls according to sex. So who do men vote for? Who do women vote for? This is not sectioned after age, which I think would show us very different results if you go for age and gender. However, so if you click on this is Infratest DMAP, so via the Tagesschau. So you see women, the majority of women voted for the CDU, 27%. Second place is shared by AfD and SPD with 18%. With the Greens coming in after at 13, then Linke at 11, which I find quite interesting because if you click then on men, you see, yes, there's a higher percentage. Again, this is all ages, which I think makes a difference. So you have a high percentage of men who vote for the CDU. It's 3 percentage points more. And it's, I can't do math, but 6 percentage points more for the AfD.
It's tricky that they never resolve for age and...
Yes. That is true. Yeah, it's always either or.
This is something that's kind of interesting, right? Like, when I was born, Germany had four political parties. and one didn't even really count. For like when my parents, for all my parents, until my parents turned 40, they had three parties to choose from. Today we have, I mean, we aren't even down the list yet, right?
Yeah.
And there are a bunch of like other weirdos we're not even going to talk about, right? Meaning older voters tend to vote, right? The large number for the CDU there is older women, almost certainly, just because older people stuck with their parties, right? Yeah. Part of the reason why young people have gone on for the AFD, in for the AFD more, is actually not so much about, it might be about radicalization, but it's also that they're not sort of locked in. There are just, I know my parents, I mean, I hope they don't mind me saying this, like have voted SPD all their life. They're going to keep doing that, right? This is what their friends vote. This is, they, you know, they have parties together. They, you know, they watch the results come in. A lot of guys sort of through unions are like, or if you're a CDU voter, you're through your church. That's everyone votes for the CDU and then you go eat dinner and wait for the results to come in, right? Like that is not the case for young people anymore, meaning that in some way the sex or age kind of gets it wrong.
And so what I did find is young women in cities and old men in the countryside as sort of comparisons. And that looks very different. I think younger women refers to everybody under 35, if I'm reading this correctly. So younger women in cities, 35% Die Linke, as opposed to 4% of, I think, men over 60 in the countryside. And if you then look at, if you control for age, this is the only one that I found that does that. And then if you control for, if you look at the AFD, you have younger women in cities 10% and for the AFD and 9% for the CDU. So that does look very different once you control.
And just to give a sense of age, what that looks like with these locked in voters, on the same site that you shared, you can see what people 70 and over voted for, right? SPD 25%, CDU 43%, right? Greens, FDP, AFD, left, all sort of between 4% and 7%, right? Like it's, this is what we mean. Like this is still a voter block. It's not a voter block that's not receptive to the AFD. It's just that they're gonna vote, like they have a very different relationship to voting and to party. And that is very clearly not true of the younger generation. Meaning the younger generation tends to switch, right? Including this time, a lot of people from the Greens to the left, from the left to the AFD, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just like a lot more dynamism. And the two, what used to be the two big parties, not anymore, really are still relying on these sort of voters that are going to pull the lever for them or make their X for them until the day they die. But the problem is that's, of course, a losing proposition.
Because those people will die. Yeah.
These people will die. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, because like ultimately they're right now a fairly stabilizing influence very clearly.
Yeah.
But if you look at sort of like, you know, people between 45 and 59, which is another big group, like it looks dark, man. Like as these people age, we're going to get... you know, the AFD thinks time is on their side, and it's hard to look at these results and not think that they're at least somewhat right.
This is something that's happening in a smaller way in the US as well, like the aging of the liberal class, right? The liberal voters are now people who are, you know, in retirement age, and the youth and energy seems to be going right wing among a lot of our voters as well. So it's not just that, you know, the constitutional order is being sort of like rapidly attacked and degraded by this ascendant right wing we have in the US. It's also the constituency for like a liberal constitutionalism is just like aging out of relevance and into smaller and smaller size.
Yeah, I think populism versus institutionalism is probably better framing than liberal versus not.
Yeah.
Because in the end, I think the left is also gonna be able to benefit from this. What this is, I mean, Sarah Wagenknecht didn't end up doing very well here, but this kind of the meme candidate, right? Your voter is no longer someone who goes to church and votes with everyone, right? Who's also at church. It's someone who makes up their mind based on a bunch of weird information, maybe a thing they saw online, maybe on how they feel about inflation. They make their mind up late. They are very activatable by like anecdotes, by personalities, et cetera, et cetera. That didn't used to be the German way. My parents would have, frankly, voted for the SPD if it turned out the candidate was a rotted pumpkin.
Yeah. Who cares?
You were subscribed. Yeah, that's very to true. This, right.
Vote for party, because not that's for what the you're candidate. Voting for, in
of
a way. Course,
right? There's a very good chance that that person doesn't even make it into parliament. So, like, you were voting for a group of people that you thought largely reflected your values. That is no longer the case, and it is, has become, you know, it as that falls away, there is a real kind of. Yeah, there is a kind of populist energy that can come along with it. That's not to say that the left can't harness that. That's not to say that it all is going right wing. But it does create a kind of volatility that the German system at least didn't used to have. It used to have, you know, about 75% of voters were just, or 70% of voters were just off the table because they were going to just check their box for one of those two big parties and the and everyone else was playing for table scraps. That's no longer the case.
Exactly. And I think what you can really see that in a way how that can work for left-leaning parties, in that I think a big part, or at least an additional part to disappointment with the rightward lurch of other democratic parties that the Linke was able to harness, is that with Heidi Reichenick, they had someone who is not just someone who, this is going to sound very basic, but who can give a good speech, which is not a typical thing that German politicians know how to do well. So the stereotype of the dry German politician, I think a former colleague of mine once said Olaf Scholz was Teflon made human.
That's good.
Yeah. So I worked for the ZDF for a while and always dreaded having to get sound bites from him, because it didn't matter what question you would ask him, it would just, that's where Teflon Man came from. Anyway, but I think the SPD really ceded some of the ground that they historically have, so they could claim historically the mantle of anti-fascism. You know, they were amongst the first victims of the Nazis after the communists, that the Nazis turned against. They were amongst those who didn't vote for the Ermächtigungsgesetz, you know? So they, the enabling laws, yeah. So they would have a historical point to make here. But with Olaf Scholz, you really have, again, that the man is the opposite of not just charismatic, but also in a time where so much of politics traffics in emotion, he does not offer what I think a lot of people thought Heidi Reichenick was offering, namely that there was an anger and a righteousness in the opposition to the AfD, which again would be a very easy play for the SPD.
It's baffling, and it's kind of the upshot of a lot of what's gone wrong with, I think, in German politics over the last couple of years, which is that a lot of even nominally left parties they are starting to make distinctions between who counts as German and who doesn't. There are a lot of voters who are just being left homeless by being declared part of the problem by politicians that are supposed to represent them. I mean, this is something that isn't shocking to Americans who have to deal with the Democrats, that you're like, you know, you after every election, you're the scapegoat. It's very clear that they say asylum seekers, they say immigrants, but really they mean your family. And at the same time, you're being told that, like, if a Nazi runs after you and threatens to punch you in the face, really what the job of a politician is to take that guy's fear seriously, not your fear for your fucking life.
Yeah.
And I think this is a real problem. The German political class, and frankly also the German media class, no longer looks demographically like the country looks. There's also the fact that because of EU liberalization of citizenship laws, there are just a lot of people living in Germany who cannot vote, right? Because they're citizens of other EU countries, for instance. Meaning the country's elite no longer has to represent everyone. It doesn't feel responsible to these to everyone who lives in a place like Berlin. They feel responsible to a place like where my grandparents live, because like no one no one is going to move there in their right mind. Sorry, it's actually a lovely place. But still, it's there's this big disconnect between, frankly, Germans who look like me and Annika and what most Germans look like now. And I think that this is going to be the demographic shift, and this is going to be the demographic disconnect that might well undo German democracy in the end.
It certainly seems like it's going that way because, you know, one might have thought that after such a historically terrifying election result, there would be, you know, it's always a good way to measure where German media discourse is to watch German political talk shows, although nobody, I believe, in their right mind can listen to more than... They do suck, but one could think that, oh, maybe this will be the new focus point. We're now going to do some shows on where the topic is, oh God, how could this happen? What are we doing? Oh, more special shows about migration. Migration, were we right-wing enough about migration? Maybe we weren't right-wing enough. There was a book, I think you dropped it in the preparation notes. Adrian, help me. What was it called again? About the crisis right of parties.
Yeah, this is Thomas Biebricher's book.
Yes.
It doesn't exist in English yet, I believe. It's very, very interesting.
Really?
If it ever comes out in English, we definitely have to do an episode on him. It's about the crisis of these Christian democratic parties that existed in every single post-war society and that seem to have eroded, sort of starting at the moment when communism and anti-communism lost its focalizing possibility. So this would be the old Tories before they went all Brexit crazy. This would be the Partido Popular in Spain. This would be the Neo Democratia in Greece, the Christian Democrats in Italy, the ÖVP in Austria, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, after 89, we do get a lot of sort of social democratic and socialist parties slowly falling apart. But Biebricher's point is like the same happens to the center right. They needed this foil. And frankly, they had a lot of sort of pluralistic head fakes in order to be effective anti-communists. Like, oh yeah, we were kind of pro-union. And the moment the Soviets are gone, you're like, fuck it. We're getting out the chainsaw and we're going bug nuts insane over here, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Fuck the unions, yeah. And what I found really interesting is that he kind of points out that just ideologically, these center-right parties put themselves in a really tough position because it then is about, you know, because conservatives defend the status quo. And then you get into a moment where the status quo, in their view, isn't worth defending anymore, which then opens up the possibility of an almost sort of potentially revolutionary right-wing element in this kind of politics. I had an interesting moment about that when I was researching my last book, which was about the history of the GOP, and I managed via a colleague to get an interview with Bill Kristol,
wow,
of all people. And I expected, because, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to ask him, do you think this is conservatism or a form of conservatism, what we're seeing from the GOP? And I sort of expected the sort of, oh, these are not real Christians, but for conservatives kind of shtick. And I think I might have caught him at a moment where he was disillusioned enough, or maybe felt guilty enough about his own culpability in bringing the GOP to where it is now, that he said, well, not sure if it is conservatism, but if that is what it is, and at some point in time, if all of these people say they are conservatives, then I can't any longer call myself a conservative, which is why I think he is going for the old liberal now,
right,
as his, what he calls himself. And I think that's also something that this book sort of tackles, because it looks at how these center-right parties are dependent on sort of an amorphous enemy figure that they can sort of identify against. And I think that's what you're seeing with the CDU at the moment. And they've you know, they've now discovered NGOs, whether that's because they listen to Orban or whether Friedrich Merz has watched a bit too much Elon Musk.
You guys have any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
I mean, one takeaway is definitely that it doesn't look like anyone got hurt by taking a strong stance against the rightward drift in society. I think that the people who were most consistent and decisive in defending multiculturalism, an open society, and just a kind of a baseline liberality, not even liberalism itself, were not supposed to win and did really, really well. There are constituents for this, and they don't feel represented, right? They're told that they don't matter. They're kind of taken for granted. And to give people an anti-fascist alternative turns out to be something that left-wing parties or nominally left parties across the globe might want to look into. It's useful, and it might even be helpful for you.
Crazy idea, Adrian. Actually stand up to the fascist drift? That's nuts. That's crazy talk.
I heard that James Carville told us to play dead, so let's do that instead. He seems so wise.
Yeah. Very wise.
He won an election once.
Yeah, about 30 years ago, and he won't have a second thought. It's like we are ruled by people incapable of having a second thought. Annika, it was so wonderful to hear from you. I feel like I am much better equipped to understand Germany now, so I really appreciate it.
Well, it was an absolute joy to be on your podcast. I was going to say extreme listener, but that sounds wrong.
Yes, I love it. An extreme listener.
I'm a hardcore listener. First time attendee.
We are honored to have you, and we're honored to have you as a listener, and we're honored to have all of you as listeners. And thank you for coming with us on this long and insane trip. But I hope it's clarified some stuff.
Thank you, Annika. And thank you to all our listeners. We'll see you next time.
In Bed With The Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.